the Triathlon Show 378. What's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I interview Dr. José Areta, who is a lecturer at the School of Sport and Exercise Sciences at Liverpool John Moores University. We will discuss the topic of low energy availability, which you have probably heard about before on this podcast, among others. But I think what is quite unique about this interview is that we go quite deep into, I guess, the uncertainty and the paucity of knowledge that exists around the topic and how much is still to be discovered. So I guess this episode, if nothing else, will help you not draw too firm conclusions about anything just from calculating a simple number. But before we get into that, big thanks to our sponsors, Form. The Form Smart Swim Goggles give you unprecedented real-time feedback in your swim training through a display on the goggle lens. You can see every split, keep track of your stroke rate, and you can use heart rate through integration with Polar heart rate monitors. And all of this will help you execute your swim workouts better through better pacing, better intensity control, and so on. You can also get access to in-depth post-swim analysis in the Form app, where you can see metrics like distance per stroke, and the app will sync your workout seamlessly to platforms like TrainingPeaks, Strava, Today's Plan, and Final Search. The app also has a vast library of workouts and training plans that you can sync to your goggles and do guided workouts, or you can even build your own guided workouts. Get 15% off the goggles with the code TTS15 on formswim.com/TTS. And thank you to Senate. The Senate Indoor Swim Trainer is a unique dryland swim trainer that allows you to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency. It is a perfect tool to complement your pool and open water swimming, as it allows you to do very specific power and technique work, including working on your catch and your core activation, and it makes it easier to stay consistent even when you can't go to the pool. You can even use it to do activation work before a pool or open water swim, or to do swim, bike, brick workouts more easily. You can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days, so if you don't love it, just send it back. And you can get a special TTS bundle, including the swim bench and a bunch of Senate training plans and on-demand workouts on senateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, here's the interview with Dr. José Areta. Welcome to the Triathlon Show, José. How are you doing?
Yeah, very good, Michael. Very nice to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, it's nice to have you. Let's start by an introduction. Can you tell the listeners more about who you are and what your research is in, and a little bit more about what has led you to work within endurance sports and science?
Yeah. So I'm José Areta. Currently, I'm a lecturer at Liverpool John Moores University in England, in the United Kingdom. I've been here for about like 5 years now. Incredible, just that time flies. But I've been doing this work on exercise physiology and nutrition for a number of years. So I'm originally from Argentina, trained as a biologist with a minor in zoology. So I have that sort of background. But then I specialized through my PhD on exercise physiology and nutrition during my PhD at RMIT University in Melbourne, in Australia. And I had a chance to work with really, really great people there. And then I kept specializing in this topic in the Norwegian School of Sport Sciences, where I spent there for about 3 years as a postdoctoral researcher before ending here in Liverpool, John Moores. And I suppose the common thread throughout my research and my work in this area has been like how we can maximize adaptation to training by manipulating nutrients. And there's a range of things that we can change to do that. Like, you know, manipulating protein, carbohydrate, and fat. And over the last few years, as I sort of find the topic that I'm more interested in and more passionate about, I've begin digging deeper and deeper in the area of like energy availability. Precisely, like what happens to the body when you're not training or you're not eating enough energy in relation to the energy expenditure that you're doing with your training.
Yeah, and that is exactly the topic that we will discuss today in more detail. So can you start by just giving a definition of energy availability?
Yeah, well, energy availability is a concept that I suppose has been built over the years. In its origin, it was more coming from sort of studies in ecology in mammals in the wild, but then it's been applied to humans. And when it was applied to humans, you know, in the early 90s is when this sort of definition of the concept of energy availability took more of a sort of mathematical calculation, let's say. Of course, there's a concept behind the mathematical calculation. And energy availability is basically defined as the energy available for physiological processes after subtracting the energy used in exercise. Typically, what is done is like normalized against the fat-free mass because it tends to be the most metabolically active tissue. So that's, you know, to be more precise in sort of the, let's call it the arithmetic definition of energy availability is energy intake minus exercise energy expenditure that is normalized to fat-free mass. Of course, there's been different iterations of these calculations through time, but nowadays, this is possibly the most up-to-date. And as simple as it sounds, there's really like a lot of nuances to how we calculate this and the origin of it. So I suppose maybe a lot of your listeners maybe want to go out running, grab a calculator, start looking at their energy intake calculated from their apps and look at their power meters and energy expenditure and maybe have an idea of, you know, what energy availability they are in every day, but it's really a little bit more complicated than that.
Yeah, I think one thing to point out there when you mentioned that the calculation has changed a bit throughout the years, and you write about this in a review paper that I'll link to in the show notes, is that you have to be really careful when you look at reference values from different studies because throughout the years the calculation has changed a little bit. So, for example, it wasn't always fat-free mass, it was the entire body mass and so on. And of course, that changes what would be categorized at, let's say, low energy availability versus a normal range. So that's one thing to be aware of, that change. One other thing that I want to ask about is how can you explain the difference between energy availability and energy balance, and why do we need a different concept than energy balance?
Yeah, that's a concept that in a way is it's quite straightforward, the difference, but at the same time, it can be a little bit hard to wrap your head around it and understand how they are different. I'll outline the things that I think are going to make most of the difference for people to understand the main difference between these two. So energy balance is basically what we think like as an output of it's a calculation that is an output that is energy intake minus all the energy expenditure processes. And so the value that you get there, for example, if you're in energy balance equals zero, it's just a subtraction of all the other sort of energy expenditure processes, not only exercise, but also like resting metabolic rate, thermogenic effect of food, non-exercise activity thermogenesis, and others. On the counterpart, energy availability is considered more like an input to the system. So as I said before, it's the energy available for the system to maintain normal homeostasis or like the normal functioning of the system. So in this case, as I said before, is the energy intake minus exercise energy expenditure, which typically is, if you're sort of in a normal state of adequate energy availability, would be a positive number. Typically, we think that, you know, what is equivalent to a healthy state of energy balance is about between 40 and 45 kilocalories per kilo of fat-free mass per day in energy availability, at least from what we know from laboratory-based studies. Now, what I think is very, very important to consider is how energy availability can be different from energy balance, that you can have an energy balance of zero and it being a healthy energy balance, but you can have an energy balance of zero and it being an unhealthy, let's say, energy balance. This is because all the energy expenditure processes that are that your body requires to stay functioning may be reduced if you are not consuming enough calories. For example, resting metabolic rate might decrease. The economy of movement might increase. So you are doing the same amount of movement, but you're decreasing the amount of energy expenditure. You might reduce need. And then when you calculate energy balance, you look at the input, you look at the output, and then they are zero. And you might think that someone is in a healthy energy balance, but in reality, they might not be consuming enough calories for what we think might be optimal, though this can be debated as well. Whereas if we consider an energy availability value is more, let's say, is more absolute, in the sense that if we know if someone is for a prolonged period of time in values of energy availability that are low, it's highly debated what is low, but just to exaggerate, let's say someone is in 10 kilocalories per kilo of fat-free mass per day for a prolonged period of time, and they reach an let's say energy balance in that case, which I mean it would take them a long, long while for that to happen. Then we can see that someone is having low energy, but they are still in a state of energy balance. That's why, in a way, the values of energy availability can give us an indication of what is the energetic state of an individual, independent from all these metabolic adaptations.
So the reason, correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, but just to make it clear, so the reason that you can have a low value for energy availability but still be in energy balance is basically that if you are in especially a chronic state of low energy availability, then the other energy expenditures of the body, including resting metabolic rate and non-exercise thermogenesis, those processes, they would tend to decrease and potentially decrease significantly, so that the energy balances out, but you still have potentially an insufficient input to the system for your complete functioning of all of your systems and tissues.
Yeah, this is correct. However, we, you know, as a caveat, we must know that this is mainly theoretical and it's based on, you know, a whole range of data. There's not really a lot of experimental data supporting this because it's very hard to put someone in a very prolonged period of low energy availability. Possibly one of the best examples of this happening is the Minnesota starvation experiment that was happening during the Second World War, where there was these individuals that were put in a sort of semi-starvation diet for a period of about 6 months. And then you can see all the total energy expenditure matching the energy intake of this individual. So showing a very clear decrease in total energy expenditure to match the energy intakes, and that this is over a period of 6 months. So in this case, you see these individuals, you know, that lost a large amount of their body weight. By the end of the period of the 6 months, there was the body weight reaches some sort of a plateau where they you know all the metabolic processes match the energy intake. So in this case, we think that energy expenditure becomes more of a function of the energy intake, really, rather than the other way around.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
And one more question that came to mind here is it seems to me that energy availability would be like the calculation, the formula that you described, it will work quite well for most typical, let's say, modern day endurance athletes that, for example, work in an office, work at their desks, and then they do a fair bit of training beside that. But in reality, most of their energy expenditure or a large part of it comes from their specific training. But if we have somebody who maybe doesn't do so much specific training, but they do a lot of, they have a physical job or things like that, then is that a challenge for these calculations? Because because you only subtract the exercise energy expenditure. But if somebody expends a lot of energy in their normal day-to-day, then that can be a bit of a different situation, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that is debating when we're working on a manuscript now, sort of debating this. But there are several things that have to be taken into consideration about like the limitations of calculation of energy availability. If that's okay, I can sort of break them down a little bit, and get to the right point. We discussed that what you are saying about the consideration of non-exercise activity thermogenesis. So all the energy expenditure that is not exercise that might sort of add to that energy budget. What do you think?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah, great. So, yeah, I think something that we need to keep in mind is that energy availability in its origins, you know, the concept. Well, as I said, like the first origin is more like in mammalian ecology, and like looking at the success of reproduction in different times of the season with the different food availability. But then, you know, it comes from lab based work. In which both energy intake and exercise energy expenditure are very tightly controlled and very, very well controlled. So when we try to take this sort of approach or to take the calculation that's been developed in this environment, which is highly controlled, and bring it out to an environment that is a lot more unpredictable and there's a lot more error, it's like a lot less precise, this is less precise and less reliable as it is being in field conditions, then we encounter a lot of problems. This is important because, you know, the precision with which we can measure energy intake and energy expenditure in the field is quite low compared to what we can do in the lab. So if we try to bring a methodology of something that is being developed to use in the lab and think that because we're able to compute a number, then that number is what it is, then we run into problems. So for you to have an idea, the typical error of measurement of energy intake, so it's a systematic bias, is that. So that's the error that you get sort of when you measure something again and again, sort of the systematic error is about like 20%. You also have, you know, random error that it can be like, I don't know, sometimes up to like 40%, depending on the methodology that you're using. So this is a very, very important thing to be considered when, you know, you have someone who's coming to you with a value of energy availability and then being like extremely concerned that they have an energy availability of 29 kilocalories per kilo fat-free mass per day. And they think they're in low energy availability for that day, and then they have to go run to fix that issue as quick as they can, when they are not really understanding that, well, there's a lot of error in calculating that value. Then on top of the calculation error, you have the uncertainty of what should be included in the calculation and what energy expenditure should be inputted in the calculation to have a value. This is relatively minor considering, you know, the amount of error that you can get, or the compounded error from energy intake and exercise energy expenditure. But it's important as well. As you are saying, you know, this formula was defined with taking only into consideration exercise energy expenditure for people that were in a lab-based situation and that who were like sedentary. So they were not, for example, I don't know, people who were working on delivering mail, for example, who are walking the whole day, right? And then their energy expenditure would be a lot higher, or doing any other physical activity during the day. So to what extent we have to consider the other type of energy expenditure as a calculation, well, that is debated. At the moment, we're trying to work out this. What would be the best approach if we're trying to bring this calculation on the field? And by saying all these things, I'm not saying that it's completely useless calculation, because it can give you a rough idea of what's happening with an athlete on the field. But I think two things should be highlighted. One of them is that you have to be very, very precise in the methodology that you use for calculation, and that requires that you work with professionals in the assessment of energy expenditure and energy intake. And the second thing is that you really have to be careful in what error your measurements have and what is the likelihood that the value that you're getting is, you know, certain percent higher or certain percent lower.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense, and I think it's a really important message always to when we're talking about any research concept or any concept for that matter. What is the potential error and the uncertainty within? And yeah, it's not necessarily as easy as calculating your single number and saying that oh, I'm good or no, I'm bad, because yeah, you need to consider those factors. And you mentioned that it's very debated what low energy availability really is or where it really falls. Can you talk a bit more about what we know about where the threshold for low energy availability might be, and what are the consequences when you are in a state of low energy availability?
Yeah, so there's this widespread idea that, you know, there's this threshold of like 30 kilocalories per kilo fat-free mass per day, under which, you know, your body starts to respond to not having enough energy, whatever that means. And again, this is based in laboratory-based studies, excellent studies, very, very good, very well controlled and very good. There have been instrumental studies for our understanding of what is the endocrine and physiological effect of reduced energy availability. But again, we need to be careful in like how we translate these findings of endocrine and physiological responses to low energy availability to what they actually mean on the field. So first of all, these studies were, the majority of them were carried in sedentary females, which, you know, they are excellent, they are very, very important, but they have a number of limitations. We need more research to understand what happens in more active people, in males, and so on. Also, we don't know what responses exist to, let's say, lower levels of, or let's say, higher levels of energy, but for more prolonged period of time, or what happens with a more severe low energy availability for a shorter period of time. We sort of talk about this concept in the review that we wrote about like low energy availability load. So that's multiplying the time that you spend under a certain, under 45 kilocalories per kilo fat-free mass for how many days. So we think there might be a relationship there. We see a very like a linear decrease in body mass, the more severe the low energy availability load is, at least in short term studies. But in terms of like, can we use this threshold universally? Well, there's a lot of limitations in like how we can consider this threshold as a value that we can generalize and apply for everyone. So I would be very careful in considering whether someone is in low or adequate or high energy availability based on just a few assessments of, you know, both laboratory and field-based analysis, because we still need to understand what all these things mean. So,
I was going to say that you have an excellent study in cyclists that is field-based, and it shows an incredibly large variation day-to-day in energy availability based on the exercise energy expenditure of the cyclists, that on days when they did a lot of training, many of them ended up with an energy availability of zero or negative even, and whereas on rest days or very easy days they were easily hitting 50 or 60, some of them anyway, and that sort of range was normal. So they were clearly not super stable in terms of how they adapted their energy intake to their energy expenditure, and I think that was quite an interesting read, but that causes a lot of challenges when we're doing things in the field, when you can't control things as easily as in the lab. What is the impact of one day having a very low energy availability and the next day having a pretty high, and then you do that, repeat that potentially, and that's not something that is very well studied, is it?
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. And I think this brings, you know, a range of interesting topics to be discussed. I think that for the most part, it's quite clear that if you are in a very reduced amount of energy availability for a prolonged period of time, this might, you know, result in negative consequences in a range of factors, you know, physiological, health, performance, etc. It's very hard to draw a line and say, well, this is very low and this is bad. There might be sort of inter-individual variation. But I think it's very important to consider also that energy might be a stressor. Energy might be a stressor the way exercise is a stressor. So the way that we think energy potentially, if that sort of generates some sort of signal for adaptation, then, you know, as any stressor, if we don't use enough of it, then that might not lead to an optimal response to training. And if you use too much of it, then that might also not lead to an optimal response to training. Of course, this is all more like hypothetical, but I think potentially that thinking energy deficit or low energy availability this way might allow us to investigate a little bit more what are the physiological responses to training with low energy.
Yeah, and what are the consequences? Let's get into that now. Like, if you are in a chronic state of energy availability, what are the potential consequences that you might suffer?
Yeah, so I think to reflect on this, we have to travel back in time to the, you know, 60s, 70s, and 80s and start thinking about what is the origin of, like, looking into this, like what was happening back then in terms of how we were understanding this field. And back in the day, there was this thing that, you know, female athletes would lose their menstrual cycle. And it was really not understood why, you know. It was like, oh, you know, what is it? Is it like the stress of exercise itself? Is something else? What is it? And there was a range of a number of studies that were able to start teasing out that it was not the stress of exercise itself, but the energy availability as such, what was generating a disruption, like endocrine disruption, that would generate a hormonal profile that would be similar to the hormonal profile of amenorrheic athletes, so female athletes that they didn't have this menstrual cycle. And there was not just the lack of a menstrual cycle as an isolated event, but there were three things that were associated to, in many cases, coexist, that were eating disorders, low bone mineral density and stress fractures, and the lack of a menstrual cycle. So in its origin, the appearance of these sort of related phenomena led to the description of what is now understood as the female athlete triad. So the idea that, you know, low energy availability as such would generate a sort of an endocrine profile similar to that of amenorrheic athletes, sort of raised this flag of saying, oh, if you're in low energy availability, then there's a high chance that you're gonna have disruption of your menstrual cycle, so your reproductive function is gonna be affected, and you're gonna be more likely to have low bone mineral density and have stress fractures, as you know, many endurance athletes have, particularly runners. You don't see that so much in cyclists. Though you see a lot of elite cyclists with a very low bone mineral density. So these have been historically the main concerns. And then and so it was all applied to females originally, saying, oh, if you have low energy availability, this is going to lead to these consequences and it's going to affect your health. And it might have, you know, potentially some effects on performance. Then there was the development of the relative energy deficiency in sport, which basically comes after the triad, And basically is a different model which tries to give explanation to what happened with low energy availability, and also has low energy availability as at its core, in as a sort of key ethiological factor to what it sort of, all the things that it generates. They also sort of describe, you know, a low bone mineral density and issues with female reproductive function, but they also extrapolate this to email, to males, and they also say that it doesn't only happen to in these three things, but there are a lot of other factors that are affected by low energy availability. So that is what these two models say.
So what would it? What would examples? Other examples be? So the reproductive system would also be impacted in males, and are there any other things beyond the bone mineral density and eating disorders and the menstrual cycle dysfunction that we can add to the list as common symptoms or consequences of red S or low energy availability?
Yeah. So here I think we have to be very careful in what the model says to what the evidence really is there to support in terms of like experimental data showing causal effect between changing energy and these effects. A lot of this information is coming from cross-sectional studies, from studies that don't show like direct causal effect. This is highly debated, and you know there's differences, let's say, between the two, if you want to call them camps, in terms of, you know, the beliefs in terms of what low energy availability may affect. I invite, you know, to the readers of your or to the listeners of your podcast to potentially read the consensus statement, and you will see in relation to relative energy deficiency in sport, and you will see a whole range of things there that are supposedly caused by low energy availability, which, you know, support is contentious, really. So I couldn't really stand behind this and say, well, this is for definite happen. It's very, very interesting. There might be a lot of other things that might be affected. You know, there's a little bit of evidence to show that there might be some effects on hematological factors related to a production of red blood cells and hemoglobin mass and so on. And there's like a whole other range of things that this model is supposed to, or the models that are there supposed to happen.
Okay, yeah, no, that makes sense. And I did have Dr. Margot Mountjoy on to talk about the consensus statement a couple of years ago, so I'll link to that episode as well. But it's definitely really interesting to hear that, yeah, there's that, I guess, discrepancy between clear causal evidence and everything that's included in the model. Good to know. And what about diagnosis and detection of low energy availability? What can you say about how that works today?
I suppose there's many things to say, but the main thing is that we don't really have a way to diagnose it, really. So from my perspective, so there are a whole range of endocrine parameters that change when you put someone in a state of low energy availability. And when we bring someone in the lab, you see, you know, things that change quite drastically and quite quick. You know, if you look at IGF-1, like leptin, you know, insulin, you know, luteinizing hormone, potentially in both in males and females, it seems there's effect on testosterone as well. And you know, the list goes on and on. T3. The thing is that, you know, you think that, well, you maybe go to your clinician and you say like, okay, give me a full test, a full analysis of all these blood parameters. But then what you're gonna find is that in the vast majority of the cases, these values are gonna fall within sort of a physiological range. So your clinician is going to look at the results of the test, and they're going to go like, well, you know, yeah, it's maybe on the lower end, but everything is normal. So the thing is that what this gives us an idea that really that your body is having a physiological response to low energy availability. So in that sense, it's very hard to diagnose from a blood test, for example. But this might give you an idea of maybe something like what's going on there in terms of like underfueling potentially. We know from, you know, before we knew about this, that endurance athletes have, male endurance athletes tend to have like a degree of hypogonadism, like having a lower level of testosterone, for example, and that there is a prevalence in amenorrhea in females and low estrogen levels. So in that case, to detect potentially a chronic existence of low energy availability is a lot easier in females than it is in males. In that sense, the fact that females have a menstrual cycle and of course men don't, it makes it a lot easier to detect potentially it's been a chronic underfueling in a female. This doesn't mean that necessarily a female would stop their menstrual bleeding if they are with low energy availability, but the likelihood increases. Also, it might be that they have a menstrual bleeding, but they don't ovulate. So there's a whole continuum of menstrual disturbances that go beyond amenorrhea. Other things that maybe could be used to diagnose that someone is in chronic low energy availability is that they have a low resting metabolic rate compared to what should be predicted using a predicted formula. So you bring someone in the lab, run a resting metabolic rate test, and then compare that to what it would be predicted. But again, resting metabolic rate is a rather noisy measurement, and it depends what sort of formula you use to compare your predicted versus your measured. It depends on the equipment that you're using. So you have to be really, really careful also on how you estimate or how you calculate and estimate this value. So there's really no one single tool that is going to tell you, oh, this person has, you know, chronic low energy availability. You know, it's a bit of a gray area, you know. It's hard to say that, you know, you can diagnose someone with this sort of syndrome, let's say, based on a few parameters. Also, because so many things have been associated to, you know, having low energy availability, that it seems that many signs could be a reason for someone suffering from this and not other things. So I think the field is at a stage in which we cannot really say unequivocally someone has had low energy availability for a prolonged period of time, unless we do, you know, a very careful consideration of their dietary energy intake, look at their training, and we look at holistically how this person is responding to their training, how they are feeling, how they are feeling, and so on.
Yeah, no, that's a good answer. It's obviously clearly not very easy or very evident, but yeah, it definitely gives us the full picture of what we know and what we don't know about diagnosing the issue. So with that, what would you say? I might come back to some more research-based question a bit later, but I want to make sure that we get some practical take-home messages out to the listeners. So I guess a lot of listeners will fall in one of two camps, and hopefully one is significantly bigger than the other. One camp is the listeners that are completely fine, but they want to make sure that they don't fall into an issue of chronic low energy availability in the future through their endurance training. And then we maybe have one camp where listeners might suspect that maybe I could be suffering a bit and underfueling a bit, and could this be something that is going on for me? So So do you have any practical take-home messages or any advice that you would give to either one or to both of those two camps?
Yeah, well, I think it's hard to give a, you know, one size fits all recommendation. I understand how alluring it can be for many endurance athletes to try to drop weight and, you know, improve their power to weight ratio and so on, particularly for those athletes in like road cycling and stuff and running, you know, where potentially dropping weight might be of a little bit of a benefit to improve their performance. I think an easy win for the vast majority of athletes, I would say, in a range of endurance sports, is really being careful with their carbohydrate intake and really pay attention to match their carbohydrate intake to their training load. I think in these cases, we see that many athletes are really under fueling. It being advertently or inadvertently, you know, if you do this for a prolonged period of time, it's going to come and bite you back. I think, you know, I'm not so conservative in terms of being fearful of someone being for a little period of time in low energy availability. The problem is when it becomes chronic. And I think one of the main things that we have to be careful about are eating disorders. I must give a full disclaimer here that I'm not an expert or anything close to that to eating disorders. But I think a lot of the time the underpinning issue is disorder eating or eating disorders rather than the effect of energy itself. I'm not sure if I'm giving you like a right answer to the question that you were asking me, but I think there are a lot of other issues related to like anxiety and depression that might as well have an endocrine effect, and it goes beyond my knowledge really. But those are my recommendations. I'm not particularly fearful of short periods of low energy availability, but you have to be careful that you are not getting into this state for a prolonged period of time. If you are concerned that you might be in the camp that is potentially under fueling, I would, you know, the first thing that I would potentially do is start looking at your carefully at your carbohydrate intake, so not think so much about like the calories themselves. Of course, this is very, very important. Protein intake is very important, but start thinking about how you are matching your training load, your day-to-day training load, the volume and intensity of your training to the current carbohydrate recommendations for adaptation and performance.
Yeah, no, that's all really good advice. One thing that I wanted to ask about, if you're somebody that is trying to lose weight, does low energy availability have any implications? For example, would you say that it always makes sense to try to lose it slowly with a small energy deficit, because then it's so easier to stay at a relatively high or okay energy availability compared to if you try to lose it quickly, in which case you would basically have to go to a pretty low energy availability?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing that you have to think about if you're trying to lose weight is why you're trying to lose weight. The second thing is like losing weight is pretty easy comparatively. The hard bit is keeping it down. Then what you have to consider then, you know, after you've thought about these things is, of course, it's like the potential risk and benefit, you know, like how risky it can be for your performance and potential for your health if, you know, losing weight is something that you really want. And then in terms of like doing it slowly or doing fast, then you have to look at your training plan and particularly pay attention at the high intensity bits of your training plan and how you're going to fuel those efforts. The more aggressive you are with your weight loss, the more careful you have to be with how you're fueling the hard efforts for the ones that you really need that muscle glycogen and carbohydrates to be able to fuel them. So if you try to apply sort of a blanket sort of low energy availability, like energy deficit throughout, and you are chronically under eating carbohydrates, then your training is definitely going to suffer. But then if you think your nutrition in a meal by meal basis, in a day to day basis, based on how hard you're training, when, and then you fuel each of the efforts accordingly, then this is going to have a significant impact in how well you can manage that weight loss.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And do we have any information or even any just educated guesses about what the prevalence of low energy availability among endurance athletes is? And that's part one of the question. And part two is there a very significant trend in that athletes training at a higher volume, let's say professional road cyclists, professional triathletes, and so on, that would tend to have a very high volume, that they are clearly the most afflicted with low energy availability and prevalence is highest there? Or do you think that it can be quite common across the board, even among amateurs training at slightly lesser volumes than the professionals?
Yeah, so these are great questions. I think, first of all, it's important to understand we have to sort of stop fearing and vilifying, you know, someone going into a little bit of an energy, low energy availability and energy deficit. So, you know, when we talk about like prevalence, it sounds like we're talking about like some sort of disease. I think what we need to take a hard look on is really like the potential negative effects, you know, when we start thinking about things that are really serious, like stress fractures and so on. Of course, we don't want to never get to that point to say that something is bad, and that's what we would want to try to prevent. But my point here, you know, when you talk about high level athletes and endurance athletes and low energy availability, and you look at the frequency that in which they might be, depending where we draw the line, then you might say, well, you know, all these people have a prevalence of you know, if we look at the cyclist papers that we publish, we say, well, there's a prevalence of 100% of low energy availability there if you look at, you know, certain days. So I think we need to be careful with that. But, you know, going to the specifics of your question, and, you know, I'm trying to be nuanced when I get into this topic, because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding. Yes, there is a relationship between, you know, athletes who do sports that are weight-bearing or where, you know, weight is an important factor, and sort of stress fractures, as well as there is a relationship between a higher training volumes and stress fractures. So these really are things that, you know, that in a way they can predict the likelihood of someone potentially being exposed for a prolonged period of time to low energy availability. If you look at more sort of cross-sectional data and comparison between males and females, then it seems that females are about like three times more likely to have a stress fracture than male. You know, looking at data from trainings, like large numbers of females and males exercising in the army, for example, the likelihood of fractures is a lot higher in females than in males. So risk factors, you know, for the most serious things are, you know, high training loads in runners, for example, more than 11 hours a week. That's a risk factor. Being involved in a sport where, you know, body weight is a concern, or not a concern, or like individuals try to get leaner, and being female, there seem to be the more risk there.
And with the female versus male comparison there, is it because females are, let's say they have a higher threshold or a lower threshold to, they're more sensitive to low energy availability, or is it maybe that they're just not fueling as much, so they are more likely to be in a state of low energy availability, irrespective of maybe having the same sensitivity as males? Do we know that?
No, we don't know. That's a great question, actually. No, we don't know. Or at least I don't know. Maybe someone knows and they can tell me. But as far as I know, let's say, you know, I think there's only one study comparing head to head males versus females in terms of like low energy availability and sort of markers of bone metabolism, for example. And then there's, you know, comparison between studies that seem to suggest that, you know, to similar levels of energy availability, females' endocrine responses are more likely to be affected. And then we have all this epidemiological data that shows that you are like a lot less more likely to have a stress fracture and you exercise if you're a female than if you're a male. Why is that the case? We don't really know. We can go into speculating about it and maybe think about, you know, because cost of reproduction is a lot higher in females, is some sort of like protective mechanism versus, you know, in males, where cost of reproduction is nil compared to females, you know, just to give you an idea, over the course of like 9 months of gestation for a female, there's an energy expenditure of about 70,000 calories. So it might be protective both for the baby and for the mother not to incur in such a high energy expenditure if there's not enough energy available. So whether that you know, the response to low energy availability is adaptive or maladaptive in females, that is information that I really don't think I'm prepared to defend with any sort of stronger evidence. And I just said, not at this time, at least.
Yeah. I know we're coming up on time. Do you have 5 minutes to do a final question and the rapid fire questions, or do you have to go? Do you have a...
Yeah, no, let's do it.
Okay. So the final question on this topic is, what would you say are the top future research directions that you would like to see the field take? What are the top questions that we should try to answer next that are unanswered so far?
Well, we're working on it. Stay tuned. So some of the things that I would really like to see is the effect of low energy availability in muscle adaptation. We have some data coming up on that, so stay tuned. I would like to see a little bit more whether it is low energy or low carbohydrate availability. We have some really, really interesting data coming up on that as well. I would really like to see if actually low energy availability as such affects performance. That's highly debated. You know, if you have low energy availability, you also have low carbohydrate availability, and we know carbohydrates are very important for performance. But if you control for that in a state of low energy availability, I'm not that sure that actually has a negative effect on performance, unless you reach to some sort of like breaking point, for example, if you break a bone. Other than that, I think we need to understand better whether, you know, energy, I think it's like locomotion is so, so important for survival that I think the body prioritizes that above everything else in terms of allocating resources. And it's only like, after, you know, it's all the other systems are affected, that locomotion and, you know, the capacity for physical performance starts being affected. But, you know, this is hypothetical at this point, but I think that would be really, really interesting to test.
Yeah. No, that's great. And is there anything that we have missed? Anything else that you would like to mention about low energy availability?
Oh, I think I could speak about this for days, but I think we brushed over like a few things. So there's nothing on top of my mind that I think we should sort of jump into at the moment.
Right. So let's finish off with the rapid fire questions. So take one sentence to answer each of these. And the first one is, what's your favorite book or resource related to endurance sports?
Oh, PubMed.
And what's an important habit that you have benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
Resilience. Keep moving forward despite failing.
And who is somebody that you look up to that has inspired you?
Oh, there are many people. But I think in the academic world, both Ben Saltzin and Louise Burke have really been inspirational for me.
And finally, where can people find you and follow you and your work?
Yeah, so the only social media that I'm still using is Twitter. And my Twitter handle is JL Areta for José Lisandro Areta. That's me at JL Areta in Twitter.
Perfect. And I'll link to your ResearchGate profile as well, where you have some of your papers are open to access there. And I'll link to some of them as well. For example, you wrote a really good review in 2021, or it was published in 2021, on the topic that for anybody that wants a bit of a more detailed but still good introduction to the topic, introduction level, I guess you can read it as an introduction to the topic if you're not so familiar with it. That's a great place to start, I think. And then there are some other papers as well that people can find from your profile. But thank you so much, José. It was great to chat to you. I learned a lot, and I definitely will stay tuned and hope to talk to you again when you have some more studies published.
Thank you, Michael. It's been lovely to chat to you, and reach out anytime that I can help. So I'm happy to help.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. I found it extremely fascinating and I learned a lot. One thing that José and I discussed after the interview was that there are a couple of screening questionnaires, the LEAF-Q and the LEAM-Q, which stands for low energy availability in females and in males, respectively, and the Q is for questionnaire. So I'll put links to those in the show notes. They can be quite useful tools if you want to do a little screen of yourself to see whether you suffer from many symptoms or any symptoms associated with low energy availability. As we discussed, diagnosis is difficult. So screening is not diagnosis, but these questionnaires can be quite helpful to see if you need to maybe seek more professional help, I guess, and go deeper into something, or if there's no problem whatsoever. At this point, recording right after the interview, I have a few main thoughts and takeaways in my head that I wanted to share, partially because I'm recording right after the interview, so it's easy for me to remember what I'm thinking. And also because this interview wasn't too long, so I feel like I have time to do a bit of a longer outro. And sometimes I just feel like I don't want to make the episode even longer than it already is when we have really long interviews. But for this one, I think that, first of all, the thing that comes to mind is that it's really difficult with the limited research available to pinpoint a threshold for what is actually low energy availability, and also knowing whether we're talking about load as a combination of time and the magnitude of energy availability. It's still, I guess, under investigation what really is it that makes you suffer symptoms and suffer consequences versus just seeing a number calculated for your energy availability. If we use conventional thresholds of 30 kilocalories per kilogram fat-free mass per day as the threshold for low energy availability, so below that you would be in the low territory, then it's not necessarily a problem to be in that territory for a day or two every once in a while. As José said, it's when it's more chronic that it becomes problematic. But here, the open-ended question is that what is chronic enough? What is too much? So there's lots of things to figure out. And while it can be fun to calculate where you stand in terms of energy availability and what your numbers are, it's important to remember, as we discussed at the beginning, that there's big uncertainty around the accuracy of that kind of number. But even if you assume that it is accurate, then interpreting it is not a very straightforward manner. And I think this is something that I have learned now through this discussion with José that wasn't necessarily as clear to me before. So definitely good to always be learning and understanding these kinds of things better. For sure, the general principle of fueling well remains, and because if you don't leave enough enough for the fundamental functions of the body after exercise energy expenditure, then eventually it will come back to bite you. So that's a pretty straightforward takeaway. There's lots to this topic and lots still to be discovered. I think it's fascinating. I hope you enjoyed it too. I will have quite a number of links in the show notes, both to research papers. As I mentioned, I really recommend the review that Jose wrote in 2021, which is called Low Energy Availability: History, Definition, and Evidence of Its Endocrine, Metabolic, and Physiological Effects in Prospective Studies in Females and Males. But also, really, if you want to check out those questionnaires, the LEAF Q and LEAM Q, then those are worth investigating. And of course, the interview that I did with Margot Mountjoy back in episode 233 on Red S is still very much worthwhile and evergreen content, really. So I recommend listening to that as well if you are interested in this topic. Now, if you want to improve your triathlon performance or work to achieve your next goal, big or small, then consider working with a professional coach or a good training plan to give you the best possible chance. You can find out more about our coaching services, our coaches, and our training plans on scientifictriathlon.com. And I want to point out that before committing to work with a coach, you will always have a free, no-obligation call with them to make sure it's a good fit for you and for the coach. And also, regarding the training plans, if you purchase them directly from us, so not from Training Peaks, but the versions that we have on the website, then there is a 100% money-back guarantee if you're not happy with the plan. So that's also a good incentive if you have been hesitating about getting a plan. If you have any questions, just email me and I'm happy to discuss and help figure out what the best option for you might be. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Form, that you can find on formswim.com/TTS. Improve your swim training with real-time metrics like pace, stroke rate, and heart rate, and advanced post-swim analysis, and use the code TTS15 to get 15% off the Form Smart Swim Goggles. And thank you to Senate. Use the Senate Swim Trainer to improve your technique, power, stamina, and swim training consistency. You can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days and get a special TTS bundle that includes the Senate Swim Trainer and a number of Senate training plans and on-demand workouts on senateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.